Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Chad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week. Be sure to check out our website, kereport.com or Corlin Economics Report for your podcast provider, where you can listen to our daily market and metals commentary, as well as this full weekend show. We are kicking off this show with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. Mike joins us on a regular basis to really outline market factors that have him adjusting his model portfolio, as well as what he sees really driving these markets forward. And one thing we should touch on here, Mike, early on in 2022 and really the tail end of last year, we are seeing this rotation, which is common in these markets. The last couple of years has been all about rotation within the equity markets, but the rotation we're seeing now is out of growth into value. Let's start there. What are your thoughts? How sustainable is this rotation?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it really has been kind of a lot of fireworks in a short period of time here, right around the New Year's. You talk about some of those sectors that were in favor rapidly falling out of favor, and those sectors that were out of favor rapidly falling into favor. I saw an interesting stat that kind of said that the first couple trading days of this year, the Russell 1000 Growth Index underperformed the Russell 1000 Value Index by its biggest margin since 1995. Another interesting stat was that energy and financial stocks, which are typically lower PE value type names versus growth, had the best start to a year ever. Now, you know, we're only talking about a couple of days, so you don't want to extrapolate for too long here. But what you're seeing is I think probably something that does have some legs for 2022. And that's because people see the Fed starting to move off the sidelines. This is the year where the Fed is getting serious about potentially hiking a couple times at least. This is a Fed that is realizing it really screwed up on the inflation outlook and is trying to rapidly get back on sides with its policy mix. And what we've seen historically when that happens is that companies that are basically valued off of the idea of revenue down the road, or the idea that they might make, you know, whatever X dollars of profit, but it won't happen for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. As interest rates go up, or even fear of interest rates goes up, the value of those companies comes into question. Anything that happens to the discount rate that you discount future earnings back to the present, which is kind of gobbledygook in the industry for saying, I think you're going to make a bunch of money down the road, but I have to price some risk into that in the present day and what I'm going to pay for your stock. As rates go up or fear of rising rates happens, you pay less now for every future dollar of potential profit. So what you're seeing is all those companies that are sort of winging a prayer, no business plan, losing gobs of money now because supposedly we're all going to be driving EVs or, you know, taking flights to the moon or whatever down the road. Those are the kinds of companies that are getting crushed. Your SPACs, your money losing EV companies, you know, those types of names, and a lot of sort of second and third tier technology stocks are getting killed. Whereas money comes out of those kinds of names, it's going into more of your traditional cyclical and value type stocks. You know, I mentioned energy, I mentioned financials. You're seeing it to some degree in even some real estate, basic materials, industrials, that kind of thing. Companies that, you know, people can look at the market environment, look at what's going on with Omicron and say, all right, this isn't going to lead to those widespread spread shutdowns we had in the past. We do have a Fed that's looking to probably be raising interest rates a few times. In that environment, where the economy is improving, rates are going up, but they're not soaring, you can take money out of that riskier stuff and start buying companies that have true intrinsic value, that can make money in a stronger economy, and that don't face as much risk from that rising rate threat. And all of that combined has kind of led to some really big moves in the short term, and probably moves that, you know, they're going to cool off not too long from now. But I do think that they're, you know, longer term, that this is a theme that's probably going to play out for, you know, the next couple of quarters at least.
Yeah, Mike, you set the table well there, because we've seen a rotation out of a lot of really what was the hot money. You mentioned some of those second and third tier technology companies, a lot of the Cathie Wood's ARK Innovation Funds. Look at what happened with some of the the movement into the meme stocks, and those have kind of cratered. So a lot of people are getting a little bit more defensive and going after some of those things like the materials. Consumer staples have done well, things like Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Ford, you know, household names. People are rotating into safer names. But you brought up energy. I'd love to get your thoughts on your outlook for 2022 in energy. We've got oil that had an amazing year last year, then sold off very hard the second part of the year, but now it's back up at $80 for crude oil. So what do you make of the energy markets here, Mike?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start with the first part of your comments and talk a little about the meme stocks. I mean, you have companies like AMC, the movie chain. It was trading for $70 back in the summer. It's trading for about $20 now. You talk about the ARK fund. It topped out at what, $160, the ARK ETF. Now it's going for $80 and change. I mean, these are, and even you look at kind of like a Robinhood, this is a hot IPO, the brokerage firm that people are trading a lot. You know, people with not very much money are trading all kinds of options and shares in these kinds of companies. You know, right after its IPO, that stock went to like almost $85. Last check recently was at $15 and change. So, you know, you're not talking about small moves in some of this high beta, high risk stuff. These kind of companies are really getting crushed, you know, but to shift gears. So again, if you were playing around in that sort of part of the market, it was fun while it lasted, but the Fed's got your number. It's not working. And I don't think it's going to work at all going forward. It's kind of what I always say. It's sort of like the wrong stocks for the wrong point in the market cycle. Whereas if you bring up something like energy, you know, it's funny, everybody wants to talk about tech, but if you look at 2021 returns by sector, tech wasn't actually the best part of the S&P. For 2021, energy, the energy sector in the S&P had the best performance of any sector, just under 48% gains. It's not like tech did poorly. It was up 33%. But again, that outperformance by energy was very noteworthy. And, you know, heading into this year, if you talk about an improving economy, you talk about a market that is still somewhat supply constrained, you talk about a U.S. environment where, you know, politically speaking, sort of the policy is still leaning against exploration, drilling, production, all that kind of stuff. I mean, politically speaking, the environment is pretty hostile towards traditional energy and really trying to move everything towards solar and wind and alternatives and so on. So in that environment where we're not drilling like crazy and we're not trying to encourage drilling, what do you think is going to happen? It's generally going to lead to higher prices. And again, if you know, not just a great 2021, but in the early days of 2022, things like the XLE, the benchmark ETF for the energy sector, broke out nicely, and it's trading at its highest level in about 2 years. So again, I think, you know, you've got a lot of catalysts for that more traditional industrial, heavy materials, cyclical stuff, energy, and so on. I think you've got a pretty good backdrop for pricing and a pretty good backdrop for those stocks. So I think that definitely that's an area that as an investor, you want to be looking at, especially when you layer on top of that, the fact that, you know, this big tech money is going to be looking for a home. You know, the overall dominance in the S&P by technology stocks, I mean, they make up far and away the largest, you know, the largest sort of weighting in the S&P versus things like energy or even, you know, precious metals or base metals and so on. So if even a few percentage points of that tech money come out and try and buy energy stocks instead and to capitalize on this rotation, it could have a lot of legs. So I think that's a good place to be.
Mike, how worried do we have to be that this rotation stops and instead of rotating money within the markets, we see money broadly exit the markets?
You know, it's interesting. If you look at past Federal Reserve hiking cycles and times when they've basically tipped from, you know, the first part of that cycle to the end days where it really causes a disaster for financial markets, it takes a while for that all to filter through. You know, there used to be an old slogan, was it 3 steps and a stumble, meaning after the third Fed hike, that's when the markets would stumble. You know, you're already seeing some volatility just before we've even gotten the first official rate hike, which the interest rate markets are kind of looking at in the March timeframe maybe now. Yeah, I don't think we're at that breaking point for markets overall, given what's happening with policy. But I would say, and it's a point we've talked about before, the economy and the markets can't handle anywhere near the interest rate levels that we had in past cycles. With house prices so much higher, with PE ratios so much higher, with, you know, bonds of all kinds trading at such low yields and so on, it would take a much lower increase in interest rates, a much smaller increase in interest rates to basically break the economy and the markets. And since something can't really happen, I don't think it will. In other words, this Fed cycle, you know, I would be extremely surprised if the Fed funds rate got into the 2% range in this cycle. I think it might barely get into what I'd call a one handle, you know, a Fed funds rate between 1 and 1.99%. And that's much, much lower than we had even in the last cycle. And compared to some of what we saw in the 80s and 90s, it's miles away from it. But that's not an accident, right? You pile more debt on top of an economy, you have much more debt that you have to pay back, and it only takes a small increase in interest rates before that sort of breaks your budget. You can't afford those debt payments. So with that overhang, we're just not going to see what we saw in the past. Long story short, I think that you probably don't need to worry about the Fed crushing the market until maybe the back end of this year or into next year, depending on what happens. So I'm not overly worried. I'm more concerned if you're in the wrong stocks, you're in the wrong sectors at the wrong time. You're going to, you know, you might see a short-term break from the hammering that just happened, but let's spread it out over the first half of the year. You probably want to go with this rotation rather than try and fight it.
Well, Mike, just along the lines of the Fed starting their rate hiking cycle, to your point, you know, at the very beginning, it's probably not going to break the market. Most people are pricing in about 3 rate hikes in 2022 and then looking at another 3 to 4 for 2023. Nobody really knows where the breaking point is going to be. But what is your outlook for how the Fed is going to be hiking into what could be an economy that's slowing down to some degree? I mean, there's the theory that it's reopening, but there's also the worries that it's not reopening. So could they be starting these rate hikes at a time where eventually, after a series of hikes, it does impact the markets and they get a breaking point and have to reverse course?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at one of the key things that helped the economy do so well in the last year to 18 months, it's been an inordinately huge amount of fiscal stimulus, right? Whether, you know, of all shapes, of all kinds, whether it's unemployment benefits, you know, child tax, monthly stipends, basically, whether it's been Build Back Better money or portions of that, infrastructure spending, the whole nine yards. Some of that fiscal money is gonna be draining out. We've actually, you know, gotten past the point of maximum fiscal stimulus, and especially if the Biden administration has political issues heading into the midterm elections, they can't get a lot of the social spending passed, and they have to show some more fiscal discipline. You're gonna drain from the economy some of that money that was, you know, freely flowing from Washington, and on top of that, you're gonna see sectors. I mean, housing demand is already curbing or falling here as a result of a, you know, relatively tame rise in mortgage rates, combined with the fact that house prices were rising much, much faster than people's wages and salaries. So there are sectors like that that are already going to slow, again, with a much smaller increase in interest rates. I mean, you're talking about 30-year mortgage rates that are in sort of that low 3%, mid 3% range. In the old days, or when I say old days, even the last cycle or two, 5%, 6% wasn't too uncommon. Could you imagine, you know, applying those kinds of mortgage rates to a housing market where a house, the average price of a house is $100,000 more than it was a few years back? I mean, that's just not going to work, right? So that's the environment that we're facing. I think I would be highly skeptical the second round of what you talked about, those 2023 hikes, is going to happen. You know, maybe we get to that 1% range or whatever, which is 3 or 4 hikes in the next 12 months. But I don't think, you know, this isn't, in my opinion, going to be anything like a Fed cycle like we had in the early 80s or, you know, the mid 90s, or even, you know, other times since the turn of the century. It just, you're not going to see that kind of constant over and over rate hikes that really push interest rates a lot higher than where they started the cycle in the first place.
So, Mike, if we take the environment that we have right now, where central banks, not just the Fed, but central banks around the world are generally going through a tightening process, you compare that to a couple years ago, especially after COVID, when all the banks were easing. And in last year, we had some very interesting economic data that came out. Economies were doing and are doing quite well. Of course, you are comparing that sometimes to these washed out economies when they're all shut down, and we're seeing inflation higher. People are clearly out there spending money. Problem is, people are building up credit card debt right now. What are you expecting in terms of economic data, inflation-wise, and simply economic data coming out of the US this year, as we do have an environment where the Fed is pulling away some of their easing, and people, quite frankly, they're not making the same money, and they might slow down on the demand side?
Yeah, I think the start of the year, first half of the year is pretty solid, pretty decent, as the Fed hikes aren't really going to bite yet. You're still going to have some of that fiscal stimulus money in the pipeline. You still have an economy that on some level, as we catch up on all these inventory short or whatever you call it, inventory lacking and rebuilding that we're going to have to do, things like that, sorting out the supply bottleneck for a lot of the manufacturing industry and so on. That's probably going to sustain us for the first half of the year. Things may get a little more dicey as we get into the back half of the year again, as the even talk of higher rates and some of these preliminary hikes filter into sectors like housing. You have some of that fiscal spending drying up as you head into the midterm elections, particularly if things aren't looking good in terms of polling for the Democrats. That is going to lead to some more questionable setup in the back half of the year. So I think, you know, as an investor, you still want to be playing for gains, following this rotation. You know, not aggressively taking money out of the markets. I don't think it's yet time to kind of sound the alarm on that. But we are going to have to get a little more cautious as we head into the back half of the year and see where things shake out. And again, I don't think you want to stand in front of that rotation freight train, because I don't think it's done going down the tracks. I mean, this is a thing where that, again, you know, you even go back. I mean, I'm not saying that we're going to see a tech stock, big tech stock crash like we saw in the early 2000s. But if you go back to the year 2000, you know, when the overall market kind of topped out, tech fell apart. It was down what, 40%, I think, that year. But things like utilities, REITs were up 20%. The Dow was, you know, down a very modest amount. Money, you know, you kind of saw a lot of the rotation around behind the scenes before everything started collapsing. You know, I don't think we're at that everything stage. And I think there are still ways to profit in this market. But later this year, that's when you're probably going to want to, you know, kind of reevaluate and see how things look.
Well, Mike, I love getting your thoughts on the precious metals and commodities, because with this rate hiking cycle starting, sometimes that's a tailwind for precious metals. But then there's also the inflation narrative, which wasn't so hot for gold and silver in 2021. But if there is a decrease of inflation and a rising in the rates, could that stall out any rally we expect in the precious metals? What's your thoughts on 2022?
You know, it's unfortunately this correction sideways, what trend, whatever you want to talk about, it has really lasted longer than I expected. I mean, that, you know, no, you've used sugarcoating that. It's been difficult, and the underperformance for metals and mining shares versus the market's been pretty significant. But even people like Byron Wien, that the famous guy who's been putting out strategist is putting out his top 10 surprises for the market since, I don't know, what, 40, 50 years or something. And one of his surprises is that he thinks gold's going to have a 20% rally, as, you know, even Bitcoiners realize they need to move some money from crypto back into the traditional stores of value. And also, if some of the interest rate pressure eases in the back part of the year, as the Fed says, hey, maybe, you know, we need to take a break and don't go so far, that could be a catalyst for that second half. So I don't hate it. I'm, you know, obviously kind of frustrated yet patient and still looking for some of that interest rate pressure to lift. When it does, I think we are going to see a pretty significant move for metals. It's just a matter of, you know, can you wait that long and can you just be patient, which is sort of, you know, among many investors, that's unfortunately a lost virtue. But I think if you are patient, you will be rewarded eventually. Again, especially maybe as we hit the back half of the year.
What's your assessment of the miners too? We talk a lot about gold, but what about the gold miners? They arguably had a great year in terms of having a generally higher gold price to sell their metal into. Problem was costs also escalated, and unfortunately their stocks didn't do very well. So that also hurts the miners. What's your assessment of the overall health of the largest gold mining companies?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, the cost issue has been a real problem for all kinds of heavy industry, mining, you know, anybody that is operating a capital intensive, personnel intensive type business. So it certainly hasn't been good from the cost side. And then again, when what you're able to sell at is just sort of stagnating. That doesn't lead for a very pretty profit picture. But, you know, if you want something encouraging and you look at kind of what happened in the mid 2000s with gold and silver, once the interest rate pressure eased, I mean, you know, you saw the Fed back off with its hikes in sort of that 2004, 2005 period, or in 2005, once they were done hiking, you know, gold took off. It went from something like $420 to $725 or so, if I'm looking at my chart here, over the next year and a half, 2 years. So if we get to a point where the interest rate pressure eases, the macro gets a little better. And let's say maybe even we've topped out in some of these inflationary pressures, then you've got a nice combination of cost pressure easing, as well as some demand and pricing power. So again, to me, it's not a situation where, you know, it's going to be terrible owning miners and you just got to get out because you're going to have lower prices in a bear market for the next couple of years. It's more of, okay, you know, understand you're going to be bored for a little while and you're not going to make a lot of money. But whenever that lid comes off the pressure cooker and we don't know the exact timing of it, I think you're going to be rewarded for your patience.
Mike, any thoughts on the base metals and battery metals? We saw copper, nickel, tin, lead, aluminum, iron, almost everything have a great year earlier in the year last year. Then it sold off some. A lot of that was with those inflationary forces, but some people think it's topped. Other people think that longer term, the commodities market is just getting started. What are your thoughts on the base metals and battery metals?
You know, I think, again, government policies in we want, everybody seems to want to move to a renewable future. They want to move towards battery power. They want to get away from traditional fossil fuel and so on. It's going to take an enormous amount of investment and a lot of time. So it's one of those things where I think you can almost make a lot, make a solid amount of money in the old school, energy type names. And you can also make a probably even better and nicer amount of money in exposure in terms of miners to any of the metals being used to power this sort of EV and renewable shift that we're seeing. So I think, you've got a lot of very sort of long-term, long cycle beneficial things going on there. And also, again, at the same time, pricing in traditional energy markets is not collapsing because, it's not something you can flip a switch and we all live in a renewable world in a year. It's going to take many, many years. So I kind of like both sides of that coin. And I think, as long as the economy is not cratering, which I don't think it's going to, your base metal outlook is pretty solid.
A lot of good thoughts there, Mike, and a lot of different sectors that we're talking about. If I can get you just to maybe summarize your key points and your favorite investments into this year. Obviously, this stuff changes, but what is your key narrative? Summarize it for us for 2022.
Sure. Fed's going to be putting some pressure on overvalued, hypey parts of the market. Avoid that junk. At the same time, I don't think we're going to be at the point where they crush the economy or the markets for a while. So rather than take your money out of the market, put it into the new sectors, the new leaders, the types of safe money type names, economically solid, nice yields, high Weiss ratings and so on that can do well. At the same time, patience in when it comes to precious metals. Don't be selling and dumping those to buy other things. Understand that the is sort of simmering right now and the lid's going to come off potentially in the back half of the year. So patience is there. And lastly, realize that at some point the Fed will become the market's enemy. It'll probably do what it's done every single time in the last 20, 30 years, which is go too far. And when that happens, that's when you've got to really start getting bearish, hedge, play for downside, put options, inverse ETFs, whatever. But I don't think that point is coming anytime soon. It's more something you want to watch for down the road.
All right, Mike, always great chatting with you. Thank you for kicking off this weekend show. We're going to be chatting with you as we progress through 2022. I've really enjoyed all of our conversations last year. So, hey, Mike, again, thank you for the time on this weekend show. I look forward to chatting with you throughout this year. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Take care.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope you all enjoyed those first two segments with Mike Larson. We are now chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Now, Dana, we're going to stick to at least initially general comments on these U.S. equity markets. We covered a lot of the rotation out of growth into value that we are seeing early on this year and at the tail end of last year. But there's something that we are chatting about off mic that just deals with the early on trading that we see pretty much every year within these markets. You were outlining these wild swings and just reallocation of capital that is natural to see very early on in a new year. Dana, take us through your assessment of what always happens early this year and how you try to trade around that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Corey. Well, you know, because of obviously tax considerations, other considerations, there are huge moves that happen towards the end of the year, whether it's tax loss selling or whatever. And then on the flip side, once the calendar flips, there's big money that is going to move in the other direction. So it's not unusual to see abrupt trend changes right at the new year, first week of the year. Sometimes we see, you know, like we saw this year, the Santa Claus rally typically or historically lasts through the first 2 days of the year. And actually it was dead on this year. But once that calendar turns, there's a lot of money that's been made, that's been waiting to move in one direction or another. You see these major trend shifts. You see these abrupt price moves across all the financial markets. So it's something that, as a money manager, I know is coming. It's hard to predict which markets are going to move which way. So you can be a trend follower, like the end of the day, that's basically the crux of our relative strength system, is, you know, basically following trends and staying in the strong areas. But the challenge is at the new year, I know that there's going to be major cross currents and trend shifts and mean reversion type moves. And it's hard to kind of predict prepare for exactly where that's going to happen. So for trend followers, it's kind of a choppy, this kind of choppy environment is kind of a challenge for us. And this, the beginning of the year here is no different. Everyone talks about, okay, this shift now, this rotation back into value and away from growth. Who's to say, you know, that's not just the, you know, machination because of the shift and the turn in the new, to the new year? You know, why, who's to say that's not money that was waiting to go in that direction because it was so skewed in the opposite direction leading into the year end? So who's to say it's that versus, you know, a permanent shift from growth to value? Because we've talked about that, you know, half a dozen times I can remember over the last year or two, where people were sure, okay, after a decade, I know this is the shift from growth to value because it's way overdue. And that rug has been pulled out from underneath that shift every time. So is this the time when it finally sticks? I have no idea. We're going to follow, you know, the data and follow the charts. And if it is, then we'll be on board with it. If it's another head fake, then maybe we get chopped up temporarily. But for us, given the new year considerations regarding how prices often move at the new year, it gives me pause in declaring that this is definitely that time when growth moves into value. I have a hard time not thinking, okay, maybe some of it has to do with the new year.
Well, Dana, because your fund that you manage and just all the investors that you coach, you're focused on the quantitative, the technical analysis, the data crunching, looking for trends. When you see something like this, where there's a narrative going around, and it's pretty heavy in the economic markets right now, that everything is shifting from growth to value, as you outlined. But we were talking off mic about a lot of people will take a position like that, plant their flag, so to speak, and then they're going to be a long-term buy and hold investor. And if it goes against them, they just keep averaging down and just keep sticking with that trade, sometimes to their own detriment. But you're taking more of an actively managed portfolio. How do you make the shifts to a general trend like that in your quantitative models when you see that there is some shift from growth to value? How do you know when it's the right time to get in and ride the trend? And then how do you know when it's the right time to get out and go, hey, we're rotating again. And for anybody that's sticking around, it's time to rotate.
The latter portion is the key. How do you know when you're wrong? You know, we've got quantitative models that help us stay in the relative strength. Sometimes there's whiplash among there. It's never perfect. It is designed to be on the intermediate term, which we call, you know, 2 to 6 months or more. So it's not constant, but there is a quantitative component to it, certainly, and we use the charts to kind of back up what our models are seeing. So there's always objective quantitative reasoning evidence behind the moves that we make. And if those sometimes those change, they've changed, frankly, over the last few months. We've seen quite a bit of fluctuation within our models and within some of the relative strength readings. So sometimes those things change. Our advice is if they change, change with it. Don't, avoid the anchoring bias where you come up with a narrative or you come up with or you put on a position and you stick with it because being right is more important than making or avoiding losses. Sometimes you just got to say, okay, well, the evidence has changed. I'm changing with it. I was wrong. The model was wrong for now. And we're shifting gears again. You got to be able to know when you're wrong. Take a quick loss before, like you said, it becomes, you know, a long-term loss because you're too stubborn to admit that you're wrong or the model was wrong, which, I mean, no system in the world is perfect. Sometimes the models are going to be wrong. And taking those quick losses is more important than, you know, trying to stick with it and eventually be proven right, which can be very financially hazardous to one's health.
Yes, it can be. And sometimes you won't be right for decades, and that can just crush a portfolio. But Dana, look, you are agile with the funds that you manage. And tail end of last year, you were mentioning that, look, it was a tougher market. You were looking to hit singles, not triples and home runs. So really just looking for some short-term opportunities. What's the strategy in 2022? Because quite frankly, even though the tail end of last year was choppy for the markets did just continue to hit all-time highs. So what's the strategy for this year?
Well, yeah, you're right. After the huge post-election rally of a year ago, from basically last spring to October or so, basically markets by and large went sideways. That's when we're, you know, playing that two-way market, hitting singles. In October, once we saw the breadth improvement, we saw charts gearing up for breakouts and maybe that next leg higher. We did start swinging for the fences a little bit, and then we saw a very unusual rug pull in November. We saw breath go from, you know, hitting new highs to falling off the table, which is historically very rare. It's almost unprecedented to see the breath and the internals fall off the table like that. So again, that's one instance where, okay, we were wrong on betting that that breakout would be sustainable and move to a new up leg in the markets, especially in the broad markets. You know, the large caps have held up better and have grinded it out to new highs, but the broader market fell off the table. The small caps fell off the table. And again, you have to have some sort of objective criteria to say, okay, that was wrong. We got to shift gears again. And since the breath fell off the table there, we've been certainly less than aggressive in the equity market, and we're still less than aggressive. We are still happy to be invested in across several areas of the market that are still strong. They're still technically in good in constructive patterns. But given the breath fall off in the broader market, we are definitely less than aggressive right now. So trying to play kind of both sides of the market, you know, be more aggressive, keep buying the dips in those strong areas of the market. But when something breaks down, get out of it, or even try shorting some of the areas of the market, hedging some of the areas of the market when they rally up into some resistance. Because, again, the indices, and, you know, I'm not the first one to say this, the indices are really masking some of some widespread deterioration below this under the surface in the broader market. We've seen lots of stocks down 20%, 30%, 40%, even with, you know, the large cap averages hanging up near all-time highs. And, you know, as a relative strength manager, that's fine. I can be largely concentrated in that large cap area of the market. That doesn't mean you got to, the breath falling off doesn't mean you have to exit the market wholesale when you do have some areas of the market hanging strong and still hitting new highs. But in the back of your head, you have to have you know, one finger on the switch once those last bastions that have held out and are hitting new highs, once those roll over, then this thing could get a little bit more serious.
Yeah, Dana, you make the case well there that even sometimes if the indexers are doing quite well, the individual stocks or even certain sectors within those indexes may not be. At one point in December, the average NASDAQ stock was down about 40%, which was not what the NASDAQ index was saying. So there's still people that could have their clocks cleaned if they were positioned wrong. Since you do kind of drill down into which sectors are moving and which ones are not, which ones are you most bullish about as we at least go into the first quarter here of 2022 that are sustaining some momentum? And then which sectors are you avoiding?
Well, I can tell you, but in 2 weeks, it's probably going to be the opposite. So I don't know. I don't know if it's even worth it. No, that's been a challenge because we've seen this constant rotation for a while. The rotation was not as damaging because it was most things were going higher for the most part last year. Even the laggards, you weren't getting hurt that bad. Now it's we're seeing a little bit more violent swings, and again, maybe some of that has to do with the new year. But you've seen, you know, obviously those value sectors. You're seeing the financials and energy, which were clear laggards coming into the towards the end of the year. Those have broken out above, at least to some degree, above some key technical levels. And those look poised to lead. Is that going to be sustainable? I don't know. But the financials and energy certainly look much better than they looked, you know, a month ago or so. And then you have some of the older relative strength names that are still hanging in there. They haven't totally broken down. Some of the technology areas. Some are getting their clock clean, but some of the areas in tech are still holding up. Semiconductors are holding up still. Healthcare still, you know, is in a drawdown right now over the last week or two, but still has not broken down. So we still have some money there. Some of those defensive names that a couple weeks ago were quote unquote the new relative strength, like real estate, the REITs, consumer staples, some of those defensive names. Still holding up well, pulling back right now, but still, you know, I would say in the broader scheme of things, still in a constructive position. So there's no shortage of areas of the market that are still constructive. But like I said before, if this thing does, if those last bastions do roll over and break some support levels, then this thing could be get kind of serious. And there's probably be nowhere to hide at that point, at least on a temporary basis. But right now, we've still got long allocation in several sectors. The question is whether they're going to hold up now or not.
Dana, are there any sectors that you are flat out avoiding that you either don't like how they're set up or you just don't understand simply that, you know what, it's just not worth even the time to try to play those sectors?
Well, some of the tech sectors that worked very well for us last year have certainly broken down. And then on a broader basis, I would say small caps in general are clear losers right now. So that would be one area of the market that I would be avoiding or even hedging with. Now, January can be a tricky month in the markets, not just the first week or so. January in general can see a lot of different cross currents. So that could change again. You know, we're kind of in flux right here. But, you know, we run the risk of being chopped up a little bit more in the short term by playing this rotation game and playing the long short game right here. Once we're through, usually January, things get a little bit more I don't want to say predictable, but reliable based on, you know, our models and the charts. But for right now, I would say small caps obviously are indicative of that broader internal deterioration that we've seen and certainly the biggest concern of ours right now.
Okay. Dana, always great having you on the show, buddy. Really appreciate all of your comments and just something for everyone to consider. Early on trading usually is pretty wild at the start of a year, and we don't know what the trends are going to be. But fact of the matter is there's a lot of money sloshing around that system. So we all need to, I think, not take too much of a bias into these markets and understand sometimes your narrative can be wrong, and that doesn't mean you should stick to a position forever. Dana, thank you again for your time, buddy. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You got it. Thanks a lot, guys.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to shift our focus a little bit more towards an individual resource company. We are chatting right now with Brian Lanny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review website, also offers a premium service to his subscribers where Brian shares specifically the companies he's investing in and why he likes those companies. We're going to talk about a company here that you recommended kind of mid to late last year to your subscribers, Brian. The company is G Mining Ventures, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GMIN. You're more up to date on this, so Shad and I are really just going to bounce some questions off you, trying to get an understanding of what you like about this company and some of the near-term catalysts. Give us a little intro, though, Brian. What initially caught your eye about G Mining Ventures?
Thanks for having me, Corey. I think the initial thing is the people that are involved. You know, again, this is something that investors always talk about in the junior resource sector. But I think it's companies like G Mining that really, it shines through that the people are so important and a big part of the reason why I think you want to invest in G Mining. The Gignac family has, you know, a long history in the mining industry. It starts with Louis Sr. He started Cambior. I think it's in the late 70s or 80s, but he built that company up into a mid-tier miner. I think that they eclipse, you know, 700,000 ounces per year production. And then in the early 2000s, I believe there was IAM Gold that bought them out. From that, Louis Sr. started with his three sons, G Mining Services, which is a mine building company. And they've built, you know, open pit mines around the world. And most importantly, for what we're going to talk to you today, they built, I think it's three or four mines in the Guyana Shield. So the, you know, the northern part of South America. So these guys have a history, you know, building companies, building mines. And now they've started a new venture, G Mining Ventures. And they've got a new project that they bought with Eldorado, which I think has a lot of positive aspects to it. And they're going to put that history to work. And I think they're going to be probably, you know, that up and coming, you know, next mid-tier producer in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, Brian, this Token Zeo project that they have, I remember it being part of the stable under Eldorado for a while and everybody being excited about its potential, but it kind of sat on the vine for a while. So it's exciting to see the project getting some work. I know they have some economics out and they had a feasibility study that was looked pretty good at $1,500 gold or even at $1,400 gold. But what are you attracted to as far as the project economics? Because I know when you go through these development stage companies, you have your own models that you put things through. What do you see in there?
Yeah. So, you know, right now, G Mining is trading at around, you know, 160 million market cap. It depends on what price you're going to use. They've got around 60 million in cash and they've got a $200 million credit facility, which I believe is through Sprott. You know, financially, they're set up very well. The Tizinho project itself, if you go through the numbers, like if you want to take the existing feasibility study at $1,800 gold, you're looking at $700 million after-tax NPV at 5%. So roughly, they're trading at roughly, you know, just under 25% of their NPV, which is great. For those that are concerned about Brazil, by my calculation with my DCF, you can double that discount factor to 10% if you want, and it still shows great economics. I think, you know, the bottom line, like we're talking about in the first question there, it's going to come down to execution with these guys. And, you know, these numbers are good on the surface, but the, you know, they're really going to have to execute, you know, given the inflationary setting that we're in, you know, prices are going up. I think investors might be concerned about the CapEx. You know, in this case, I think it's around $440 million that they need to build this. And that's a couple of years old. So you're going to expect some, you know, inflation to that. But if you look at the history of these guys, they've come on budget or below budget in each of the open pit mines that they've constructed. And I expect that to come in here. You know, the long lead time items such as the ball mill, they've already ordered. They did that last fall. And that's why they did that preliminary financing last fall. so that they could order those items. I don't know if that fully locks in the price, but I think, you know, obviously these guys are very aware of what needs to be done over the next year and a half. And, you know, all those ducks are kind of in a row. So, you know, yeah, CapEx, the MPV, all those things to me are in line, and the production profile is quite strong. And I think, you know, what they've got planned in this Q1 is going to really set them up well for the coming year and ultimately the construction decision.
So you made the comment there about a year and a half is the timeline that I guess you're giving them, or that we really should see some progress being made towards more of a construction decision, or really the start of construction. What are the catalysts in terms of what the company still needs to do in your eyes to continue to move this forward, and then who knows, move up that development curve and get potentially that re-rating?
Okay, so to my knowledge, the last time I spoke to the company, basically Q1 breaks down. They're going to do a 10,000 meter drill program. Most of that is going to focus on infill drilling and, you know, testing out. You know, grade control is obviously very important, and these guys know that a good start is important. So they're going to focus a lot of their attention on that. They're going to do an optimization studies. You know, this is project layout, some of the engineering work for the plant. And then that's going to lead into an updated feasibility study. And this is where we should get another glimpse at what this is going to cost. And that should be completed within Q1. And from there, they're going to have to put together the money and head towards a construction decision. And then over there, you know, I'm not exactly sure. I put a year and a half. That's kind of what was in my mind. You know, mid-2023 is maybe where you're well into commercial production, or maybe you're just starting there. But it's a rough timeline in my head anyways. That's basically what you have to look forward to in the first half. It's like, you know, it's a vital importance for them to complete that feasibility study and then raise the money. And maybe that's one of the big question marks that investors might have, is whether they're able to raise it. But if you look at the guys that are invested in this company, you've got Sprott's, you got the Lundins, the Gignac family themselves own, I think, close to 12%. I don't think money's going to be an issue for these guys, you know, once they've done that feasibility study, as long as there's not something not glaring that's sticking out to people. I think the money's going to be readily available to them, and they'll be able to move forward. So that's what I would look for, is the next 6 months. And then from there, we'll have to go one step at a time.
Well, Brian, another thing that we have actually talked about this project on the show before, because Sailfish Royalty used to have 3.5% NSR on this. And they, over the last year, did two transactions, one with Osisko Gold Royalties and one with Metalla Royalties. And I noticed that in November, on November the 24th, the G Mining Ventures actually bought down 1% of that 3.5 net smelter royalty, taking it down to 2.5%. But you were mentioning off mic that they have some options to even reduce it further. Walk us through that part of the equation.
Yeah, no, it's the good catch there. And that's, you know, again, you know, even before we just talk about the royalties, I think that, you know, this is a deal between G Mining and Eldorado. In my view, I think this deal was constructed in a fashion where, you know, besides, you know, all the success that the G Mining guys have had in the past, I think this deal is set up for them to succeed. You know, there's deferred payment. I think it's around $60 million that comes a year after commercial production. And then how it was financed, and then this royalty buyback. I think these things were put into the deal to make sure that this mine gets constructed. And then, like you said, yeah, they bought back that 1% late last year. And then they have the option, I believe it's upon construction. Once they make a construction decision, they have 30 days to buy back, I believe, up to another percent back of that royalty. So again, you know, these are major, major positive steps that they're taking, and reasons why I think they're going to be successful even amongst this, you know, highly inflationary environment that we live in today. Again, yeah, I think that, you know, this is set up for these guys to execute, and they've got all the tools to do it.
So Brian, if everything moves along according to plan, the updated feasibility, the construction decision, the company even manages to raise money, what does this company look like to you in terms of comparisons to other resource production companies when, let's say, the project is up and running, in terms of production profile and in terms of what you think is possible market cap wise?
I don't think we have the full picture of G Mining. Like, I had a good discussion with Louis Pierre. He's got a grand vision. I think you're going to see more transactions. I don't think Tizinho is the last one. Again, they've got a $200 million credit facility, and I think that's specifically to buy more projects. Again, you know, that's why I like this management team, because I think one of the big doubts you have when somebody says they want to be the next mid-tier producer, or, you know, move from a junior developer into a producer, is really can they execute? And the big unanswered question for them, I don't think is can they execute. It's probably more related to, well, it still is if they can execute, but it's probably more related to the financing and all the stuff that comes along with that. And so I see these guys as a next mid-tier producer, just like his dad did 20, 30 years ago. I think that's where these guys are headed. And, you know, could they be a billion-dollar company? I think without a doubt. And, you know, you take a look at those other mid-tiers that exist today, and I think that, you know, that's definitely in the realm of possibility. The other side to it is, I wouldn't be surprised if a company like Eldorado takes a keen look at what they're doing. And now they've got a strategic position, a part of the deal with shares in the company. Maybe G Mining gets taken out before they even become that mid-tier producer, which, you know, depending on your perspective, is good or bad. So again, I think these guys have all the tools to execute and become what they say they're going to become, and they'll make the right decisions in whatever they choose to acquire. It's just going to take some time and, of course, money. And yeah, that's kind of my perspective.
That was actually one final question that I had is, do you see this being a takeover candidate, or do you see this company continuing to grow through acquisition and bringing other projects online?
I guess it depends. There's a couple factors. I think first, it depends. They have to be successful. You know, they have to execute on Tizinho, and they have to bring that to commercial production. And then, of course, you know, with whatever other acquisitions, they have to continue that, you know, positive train of news. The other side to it is, I guess it's sort of market dependent. If the market cap remains low, I think, you know, very much you could see them get taken over. You know, if they become a producing company and the market still isn't recognizing their value, then they become very appealing. But, you know, maybe if the market cap, you know, starts trading at a premium, which I think is quite possible depending on what gold market we go into, maybe it's not as appealing. So, you know, those are kind of the standard things with any company, but I think it's both. And I think that there's a high probability that these guys get taken out before they even become a mid-tier. The other side to it is, don't forget, there's a lot of insider ownership to this. So it's only going to happen if they want it to happen, if you get my drift. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yes, we will. But hey, I really appreciate you sharing this recommendation with us. You and I had talked about this for a little while leading up to this interview, and we just wanted to get all the information out as best as we can. If anybody has any follow-up questions for Brian regarding G Mining Ventures, or wants us to reach out to the company, or any questions for the company, please email those to us, along with all of your thoughts on this weekend show. And again, please remember to go back through our website throughout the week, listen to all the daily editorials and all the company updates that we release kicking off 2022. Brian, thank you for wrapping up this weekend show. And everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. We'll be back with you early on next week, continuing our coverage on markets and metals. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend.